As some of you might be aware, myself and Julie went over to England, and we did readings in Coventry and Lichfield and in Birmingham. And in Coventry and in Birmingham, it was like we kind of like Irish connection that was kind of foremost. And when we went to Lichfield, there wasn't so much the Irish connection there, and we met the Lichfield writer group. And I'd been thinking to myself, I've got this poem about like England and the English, and it was kind of like, you know, angling where I was going to do it. So I kind of decided in the morning that it was going to be Lichfield. So there, I mean, they were the Lichfield writers group, so they were basically middle-aged, middle-class bunch of 30 people, and they did a really nice show for us. And myself and Julie were up at the end, and I was kind of like going, oh, fuck's sake, here's my poem going up. So, to put it in some kind of perspective, do you remember Cool Britannia? Tony Blair was elected, Cool Britannia. It was cool to be English. Jeremy Paxman wrote a book about the English, and you know, the story of the English, and how great it was to be English. And, Jeremy Clarkson also wrote a book about the English and how it was great to be English. And I was sitting up in Scotland looking at all this and thinking, lads, this is fucking comedy gold, like, you know? So this is my contribution to the celebration of Englishness. It's called England's Self-Image. And please remember that when I wrote it, and as I told them, my tongue was firmly in my cheek. Okay. From north and south and from east to west, it seems the English are depressed. No national pride or feeling good about their common nationhood. And nationhood is the issue here. Though north and south drink different beer, and east and west we argue long and hold each other in greatest scorn. But even all this regional strife does not explain the common sight of English folk apologising just for living and surviving. I'm watching the telly with my dad. On comes an IKEA ad. They're selling furniture, it seems. Don't be so English is their theme. What can be this country's bane? So bent its people's backs in shame. Look there, it's John Peel denying loud that English he can be and proud. No longer now is Britain great, it's a small collection of third world states. But to doff his cap and bend his knee, the Englishman will soon agree. Such lack of pride and common weal, like an open sore that's hard to heal. This schizophrenic identity is the bastard child of slavery. And there's some would say, and some would claim, and others more would say the same, that England built its reputation upon the backs of other nations. I'm going to take a breath. How now to heal the kingdom's woe, relieve old England's mortal soul, help the bygone crimes to mend, and from the past the future blend? Because sometimes when the football team pursues another World Cup dream, or first 11's bat and score, then you hear the English roar. Then you'll hear the English chant with fife and drum and song and dance, and celebrate with much acclaim the victories won in their name. So hope there is, hope abounds, that the English state will come around to value its citizens equally and govern with integrity. The English folk, of different colour skin, will recognise themselves as kin, and the salad bowl of modern life will put an end to racist strife. And in the future, we will see an England full of life and free with civil rights and integration to build a cheerful, healthy nation. Though the Scots and Irish would declaim, and the Welsh would likely say the same, that to teach the English how to cook, now there was a millennial project that was well worth a look. Thank you.
So this poem is actually called Cassio Wonder, Love the Common Denominator. Stern-faced tutor instructs that zero never divides, and shows glassy-eyed pupils the errors of mind and calculator design. Answer on screen shown, error unknown. Mathematicians tried to understand zero's divide, but centuries rolled by, and heads scratched raw, never answering this law. It does not happen. The words of impossibility like a snare in the empty air between the crevices of one boy's ear, as he sat with his ear facing tutor's face, austere. A drone language of arithmetic lulls in air like grey clouds that enshroud the glimmering wonder of one boy's universe, where somehow zero will divide. It whispers to him like obsession. It fills his imagination, an intricate procession of determination in Casio pressing. Button after boring button, zero into one, NA, zero into two, NA. He pressed it for days, weeks, months, and years, till one day it did not say, NA. Worded on the Casio's green screen were numerals unusual. 3 upturned V, 07. Question marks arose in his mind's eye. They hovered like question marks following Y. He pondered, what is this? Arithmetic magic? Centuries of head scratched raw are now come to a halt. 3 upturned V, 07. 3 upturned V, 07. 3 upturned V, 07. 7 billion divided by 0 is 3 upturned V, 07. What must this mean? He peered it closely for days, weeks, months, and years, till one day he flung it, frustrated and jaded, after so much time wasted. And then he saw something different about the tiresome 3 upturned V, 07. A new way of seeing was just 180 degrees of being. It was all turned around, the Casio was upside down. 3 upturned V, 07 was now spelling love. Nirvana like lightning strike, new insight to the emptiness of love. An eloquent procession of words rolled out, and from his mouth to the people, he declared the answer of zero's indivisibility. Humility awash over him, the cruxes of attachment melted and bent. Truth streamed over his person and history, like a dusty cosmic chest. Unhinged, light and clarity benevolent, sang from the trees a certainty searched for centuries. Love is zero and its divisibility runs through humanity for eternity. 7 billion into emptiness, diving into the red as it divides itself between living and dead. The balance is endlessly finite, a come and go of life and death, and what is the balance but a spiralling ascension of numerical paradox, twixt life and death, and yet love does not recess, does not grow, forever turning vermilion zero. His words of wisdom travel to the spaces of air in the crevices of ears, and the aimless mannequins animated, faces alight with new truth and insight. Love is zero and infinite. Atop the common denominator we stand, and to the half-life of love we dive. 3 upturned V, 07, until we die.
Thanks, Jess. Very interesting. Thank you. Next up, five-word chant, Michael Ray.
Do you remember what your tears are made from? Above me, light slides in and tangoes with swaying beds of kelp. It's working with the spheres, keeping everything in flux. There's a vibration coming from a shadow on the surface. My colours change, a firestorm of skin and ink smoke. You fall back into this realm, joints crab-like, breath bubbling. We shared this world 400 million years ago. You, some bony fish who crawls through mud, claimed land rights and airspace, while we remained nurtured by our ancient mind. Even from this distance, I can tell you're now warm-blooded, hair trailing, net conspicuous. Do you suppose we don't know about aquariums and fish shops, tank-tapping children, slippery deaths? I melt into the cold, ghost grey, unblinking in gloom. limbs pulsing, blood blue rhythms. Your heart still flutters, but you don't hear the humming stars dance their dream of water. You continue on your way, ignore our conversations. Soon the sea will flood the rooms of stone that you have bound with sand, and my tentacles will seek you out, suck away the scent of your ancestors.
Translation from a small part of an epic comic Spanish poem from my favorite Spanish poet, who's Luis de Góngora, who's a Baroque poet who's very well known in Spain because he's in the Spanish-speaking world because he's absolutely wonderful, but less well known because it's difficult to translate and difficult to bring across, which of course is the challenge. I've just done a few verses of this long poem, and they're near the start, they're just setting the scene. Right at the start, there's a lot of classical references, but it's just at the start, once you get over that hump, there's none then. So instead of explaining them, I'll just say that they're there, I'll just glide over them, and they set the scene. It's basically just Polyphemus, it's the Cyclops, the woman in the Odyssey as well, and it's just, he lives up on. Yeah, it's in Sicily, and he lives in this cave, and it describes the cave, and it describes him, and that's all. And it's got, obviously it's a Baroque poem, so it's got convoluted syntax. So it's like with John Donne or things in English. It's a bit of a ride, but I obviously feel it's worth it. So this is it. Where the Sicilian sea foams and surges, shining Lilybaeum's boot silver as it strains, whether the vault of Vulcan's forges or the tomb of Typhon's remains. And if not of sacrilegious urges, the ash spread palely over the plain tells of sweat and toil, while yonder a crag stops the mouth of a cavern like a gag. Before this rock in rough array, a garrison of trees whose leafy knits let in less clean air and light of day than the stone's parsimonious slits. And exposing the insides of the cave, for bleakest nights are vile exhibits, a throng of black vermin in flight, turning gravely and moaning of their plight. The greatest terror this mountain holds, its Polyphemus, for whom this black tremendous yawn, this melancholy cold, is a shady shelter, a barbarous shack, and a roomy pen, which easily enfolds as many goats as hide in the winding tracks of the mount's harsh peaks, copious reels which a whistle assembles and a boulder seals. A lumbering mountain himself you'd vow, this son of Neptune, this Cyclops whose eye shone so intensely in the orb of his brow that it vied for brightness with the sun in the sky, to whom the doughtiest pine tree would bow and serve as a walking stick, so docile, so shy, bending like a reed under his mighty heft, to be a cane one day and a crook the next. Black and wavy is his hair, reminiscent of the obscure undulations of the leaf. Wild it flies, unclean it hangs, grossly kempt by the tempestuous attentions of the breeze, whereas his beard is a riotous torrent, recalling the scorched trails of the Pyrenees, which floods his chest and cleaving fingers traverse, rarely or uselessly, or making it worse.
Thanks, Donald. Next up, Seamus Harrington.
Fine. I'm just going outside, and maybe sometime. We glance at one another in dismay. Nobody speaks. Dry-mouthed, I stare at the back door. In moments, our barman returns, rattling his bucket of ice. Mobile dog wash. It's just across the rows of deadly spinning wheels, where every puppy shows the cleanest pair of heels. This could be here, or in Galicia, or Argentina. It's called Friday evening. Spyglasses enlarge, lead lights reveal, compass concurs, surfers reboard, harbour enfolds, winches recoil, brothers divert, seagulls gyrate. Fenders defend, cargoes discharge, prawners retail, topsides rehose, netting re-knots, sailors regale, forecasts absorb, galleys entice. Skippers equate, kettles proclaim, schooners decant, legends relate, deadlines discard, outboards retilt, dry glasses reduce, textures contact. Punters pontoon, potters rebate, divers divest, shrimpers unpot, canoes recanute, ladies restroke, grapnels ungrapple, sheetings uncleat. Jet skis desist, circus loud hails, railings restrict, slipways congest, trailers uncouple, bylaws adhere, forklifts frequent, heron hijacks, show-offs breaststroke, painters retouch, seacocks receive, ensigns referral, anglers escape, charcoals depict, sundries restash, poodles repaddle, tankers refuel, tourists day trip, grey seals resnatch, flake ice replenish, chandlers equip, bilge pumps regush, logs to update, yawnings recover.
Thank you, Seamus. Next up, we have Eugene.
Easier to take the light out of the dark out of night, green out of grasses, than to end our friendship. We cupped our hands and howled at the moon, made green glasses, honey sweet, she made.
Thank you, Eugene. Now we have Afric.
The sea is dream. The sea's dream is the ship, endless travellers in tandem with the sun. The sea's dream is the ship, fleeing an hourglass emptiness, still unknowing. Only the albatross, lumbering silently overhead, sees the peopled architecture. Red cushioned map, undone bow tie, grim hoodie on deck watch. The sea's dream is the ship, heading into evening, percussionists playing silence from the shore. Those battened behind stare as the apparition surges beyond vision. The sea traces patterns of freedom over an ocean planet, over the ballet of manta ray and slow falling fish, everlasting underwater flights, soaring from equator to pole. Trailing the ship, a single raft kneels under nicotined moonlight, inviting travellers to kiss the sea's ever-changing reflection, unfold vestigial gills, and fly down, down, down to the sea's secret garden, our deepest memory. The sea's dream is the ship, a siren endlessly luring travellers back to the beginning.
Thank you, Albert. That was beautiful. Next up we have John. Is it McNally?
McNally.
A lot of poems about eggs are about their destruction, scrambling or breaking for omelets. But here's one about creativity and nurturing. For instance, imagine if we, as humans, instead of nurturing grudges and frustrations internally like babies, could build them up until we lay them as eggs, and incubate them until they hatch as a fertile hen, or even better, as a proud cockerel. So we could send them over to peck those fuckers' eyes out.
Thanks, John. Next up we have Sean and Harry.
This is my first time reading poetry in front of people. I'm a bit scared. He's been blushing, so I'm blushing. It's called Siblings. We were born backward, or too big or together. We were born perfect and planned. We were born free of conformity. We were raised sideways, but always up and always hopeful. We were raised kissing and holding and together. We were cared for equally, but individually. We were cared for regardless. We aged differently, sent to school one after the other. Still, we always found each other with our backs against the wall. We fight our own fights, but we bleed each other's blood, and we are angry because we don't know where the love goes, and we don't know what they know, not to hug your brother, and not to carry your sister, and not to love with passion that they grant. We may resent each other, and we may change our nature, and we may seem to belong, but we will always stand together, knowing what they don't know, and feeling what they can't feel, with our backs against our wall.
Thanks, Shauna. I think I hope you'll read again here. Next up we have Dan.
No, okay. No difference. Go Dan. Dress the mate before you have that.
The best naturalist writer of all times came from Argentina in 1880. He died in London in 1920, and his name was W.H. Hudson. Nothing got to do with this poem. I'm lucky enough to live in a place occasionally and can say that was saved from being the violence in the boom period, from hotels and a hotel and golf course and a couple hundred houses, and on it there's a an ancient grave that's 4,000 years old. And we call it the Chieftain's Grave. But on the old maps it's called the Prince's Bed. Chieftain's Grave. In those times I would sit there on that ancient grave and see nothing except the sea and the sun dropping diamonds blinking at me. I only heard the lapping of the waves, the floating fulmer, the lark away in the clouds, as if in some kind of trance, and then only to ascend in his majestic pendulum dance. I could only feel the warm grass, a slight breeze upon my feet, the buzzing of the cricket in my ear, an antique collective anthem circulating all about in some kind of glorious quantum. Now, in these times, a rumble from beyond the head that fills mine with fear, the strangest ever sung, as if the seas are parting and the breaking of the ground. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you, Donald. Maybe that's Irish for Dan. next up, we have Stanley Knott.
Thanks again. I always have to introduce this. What I do is with these series of poems, I take song titles from bands and I combine them to make a piece. So all the titles from one band, this is from Blur. And I think the thing that interests me about this is when I started the project, I just kind of took the titles and kind of left them do their own thing. But this is the first one where I consciously thought about what the band represented to me. Just so as I can bore you in totality, I'm going to explain that to you. And Blur for me were kind of a 90s version of the Kinks, very English band. But then they were infused with this thing about America kind of impinging on what Englishness was to them. So I've tried to represent this in this poem. You can tell me later on how badly I fit. So London loves to shimmer when there is a law hanging over Garden Central. Day upon day, brothers and sisters sing Oliver's Army over coffee and TV, while long-legged boys and girls tame blue jeans on the way to the club. High cool, hey? Don't be a fool. Look inside. America, magic America, gene by gene jets into Arnold saying. Because advert repetition is the universal dancehall, and their stereotypes that entertain me on Threadneedle Street explain commercial breaks being the great escape. So you can substitute London Loves to Shimmer with a luminous St. Louis trailer park. We're out of time. The people in Europe have resigned. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley. Next up is Cedric.
This one is actually inspired from the time I lived in Budapest, in Hungary, because color in Hungarian is translated in sin. So this one is called Suspicious Who. I wear my skin color like an explosive color. I am not guilty, yet I'm charged. Innocence here is innocence what protects you. In this place, color is sin. Mine is a symbol of pride and envy. My skin tone triggers and detonates, load of fear and awe. In this place, color is sin. I cannot hide and remain unseen. I am seen in the east as a beast of sin. I am believed to be a stallion or the carrier of pests. Even so, I carry on, I, an African man in Budapest.
Christy Parker. It's strange that the poet formerly known as Don, and you should mention Pino Paul because I'm going to do the same thing. There's a bit of background to this poem actually. I come from town talking about something here called York, and it's fairly bad unemployment down there traditionally.
But in the early 1980s, Yall had the temerity to reject a chemical plant for a town. There was a big national and international campaign against it. People took to the streets, etc. And the company I called Merrill Dow, I have to make that in reference because it's included in the poem. And Merrill Dow was then packing, basically, because the people of Yall, even though they were poor and deprived, they weren't suicidal, and they did not want a chemical factory outside our doors. But in the meantime, it has been said, and has not been proven to be otherwise, that the IDA and Cork County Council, perhaps, and a few other people who would be in the business of providing work and factories and stuff for people, never forgave Yall for its error. And hence, in the boom years in 2007, in this instance, when everywhere else was booming, Yall people were emigrating like hell because they had no work. Yall was in depression long before the rest of the country was in depression, and it remains so, sadly. But in any case, in 2007, Fianna Fáil, and the Minister for, I think he was Minister for Enterprise at the time, Micheál Martin, decided to honour us with a visit and render us some hope. And this poem is a reflection on that. Also, by the way, it has sort of a resonance of the Percy French song, Are You Right There, Michael? I might be familiar to some of you. It's about the West Clare Railway or something like that, if I remember rightly. It's about to do with that. But in any case, you must be warned, there's a slight lyricising or singing, if you like, in this, and I'm going to be doing it, so yeah. Keep the door open, because I snore better than they sing. Right. We had dreams of Yall towns full employment, with no businesses scattered about, as Fianna Fáil made a deployment, the head of us all raising our stout. But he sent Micheál Martin to meet us, and flash us a confident smile. He showed up in a limo to greet us, and our councillors turned out in style. But as they stood round in the rain, some poor smart arse made this refrain. Are you right there, Micheál, are you right? Do you think you'll get us jobs before the night? We're so long waiting, Mr. Martin, do you think you should be starting? Well, you might know, Micheál, so you might. They poured wine and they had cheese in the chamber, and the councillors' wolfed eyes looked up as they quaffed the remainder in the hope of some magical prize. Could Blackwater Cottons reopen, or your carpets become a hotel? If so, then our present were hoping they would be re-elected as well. But as the evening moved on, inside their heads echoed this song. Are you right there, Micheál, are you right? Is there even a false scheme or two in sight? Oh, there isn't, well, be gosh, you might have news tomorrow. But you might know, Micheál, so you might. In the chamber, chin rubbing was rife, and outside the clouds gathered with haste. Never before in anyone's life there's so much ham, cheese, and wine gone to waste. Then the minister found inspiration. He said, I might have a cash cow. I can't promise decentralization, but I could call back Merrill Dow. And as the blood chilled in their veins, the councillors dispatched constraints. Are you right there, Micheál? Are you right? Can you say goodbye right now before we fight? Can you take your limousine and stick it where it can't be seen? Well, you might know, Micheál, so you might. Yeah, you might do that, Micheál, so you might. Thank you.